Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the May 10 through 16 edition of The Economist. We'll begin as usual with The Leaders, a collection of five articles this week, chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first, and this is the cover story, all grown up. Saudi Arabia is pulling off an astonishing transformation. The subheading, Mohammed bin Salman is going from troublemaker to peacemaker. Second, an existential struggle. What Putin wants and how Europe should thwart him. Subheading, many Europeans are complacent about the threat Russia poses and misunderstanding how to deter its president. Third, the Himalayas of peace. Luck stands between de-escalation and disaster for India and Pakistan. Subheading, sooner or later the luck will run out. Fourth, Israel's forever conflict. The war in Gaza must end. Subheading, America should press Benjamin Netanyahu to accept a ceasefire and then press Hamas to disarm. And fifth and finally, illusion of control. Donald Trump is right to ditch Joe Biden's chip export rules. Subheading, time to get realistic. Following the reading of those five leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain, all of course, as time allows. So, turning now to that first leaders article, we have the title, by the way, this is the cover story. We have the title, All Grown Up. Saudi Arabia is pulling off an astonishing transformation. Mohammed bin Salman is going from troublemaker to peacemaker. When Donald Trump lands in Saudi Arabia on May 13th for the opening state visit of his second term in office, a reprise of his very first state visit 8 years ago, you should pause for a moment to take in just how unexpectedly the situation has changed. Mr. Trump has become wilder and more autocratic. By contrast, his host, the crown prince and de facto Saudi ruler Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, has transformed his country into a force for order. The familiar image Saudi Arabia conjures up is not just of fabulous riches, but also of political repression and the subjugation of women. The kingdom has exported religious extremism and therefore shares responsibility for the terrorism and violence that this has fomented. Today, the country is still an autocracy. Its crown prince does not tolerate dissent. However, the Saudi Arabia you used to know no longer exists. The kingdom is now a stabilizing influence in the Middle East. At home, it's undergone a stunning social revolution that has few parallels. The pressing question is over the third part of Saudi Arabia's transformation from a petro-state into a globalized 21st century economy. Here, change has begun, but it is not fast enough, with potentially grave consequences for MBS's entire project of reform. The most surprising attribute of the new Saudi Arabia is its constructive role in world politics. The kingdom has both oil wealth and a hefty population. That clout once made it a menace. It was a financier and exporter of jihadism. In 2015, after his father, King Salman, ascended the throne, MBS began a disastrous war in Yemen against the Houthis. In 2018 came the shocking murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and dissident on the orders of the Saudi regime. The stain of those disgraces remains, but Saudi Arabia's recent actions count for something, too. It no longer sponsors terrorism. It now counsels other countries to wind down their conflict with the Houthis. It has helped Syria's new government by paying some of its debts to the World Bank and promising to invest in the country if American sanctions are lifted. Saudi Arabia's influence in the region and with Mr. Trump means that MBS could yet do more. His country has already hosted talks aimed at bringing a ceasefire to Ukraine. He advises deal-making with Iran and an end to the war in Gaza. America's president might just listen. One reason for believing in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy rethink is that it furthers MBS's central concern, which is to bring about bold social and economic change at home. He needs those changes because oil revenues cannot be counted on to sustain Saudi Arabia forever. If young Saudis, who are two-thirds of the native population, are to thrive and, in the long run, to sustain the House of Saud in power, they need jobs. An unstable neighborhood is a headache because it inflames Saudis at home and raises the risk premium foreign investors attach to the country. A flourishing Middle East, by contrast, would mean more customers for the products Saudi Arabia hopes to make and for its glittering new tourist resorts. Social change is the second component of MBS's new contract with his people, and it has been nothing short of extraordinary. Less than a decade ago, half the country's population, its women, were shut out of public life and much of the labor market. Cinemas and concerts were banned. Any fun was had indoors, in the desert or abroad, away from the eyes of the religious police. Today, women are free to travel, work, and live where they like. The Vice Squad has been disbanded. Like the rest of the world, Saudis can now watch rock stars on stage and superheroes on the silver screen. Even in conservative parts of the country, crowds of young people are out and about, reveling in their new freedoms. The area where Saudi Arabia's reinvention remains incomplete is the economy. Since 2016, the government has spent heavily in order to diversify away from oil. The main targets have been gaudy giga-projects, such as the futuristic city of Neom, that's N-E-O-M, and a giant cube the size of 20 Empire State Buildings, which by 2030 were projected to gobble up nearly $900 billion. To cultivate new industries, the Sovereign Wealth Fund has backed more than 100 firms in areas from electric vehicles and e-sports to coffee making and chip manufacturing. Despite this, the economy remains stubbornly oily. About 60% of the government's revenue still comes from selling crude. Although the hospitality and leisure industry is thriving, the flood of money being challenged, or rather channeled, into public spending is raising costs and crowding out private enterprise. Foreign investors are not yet excited about Saudi Arabia. Worse, the fiscal strain is growing. Oil prices are at $61 a barrel, well below the $92 that the IMF reckons the kingdom needs to balance its books. The country's debt stock, though low, has doubled as a share of GDP since 2016, although Saudi Arabia has got off with a so-called reciprocal tariff of just 10%, Mr. Trump's trade war will only worsen the strain. If the world economy slows, then oil prices and foreign investment could sink further. No more white camels. To truly transform the economy, MBS must seize the chance to curb vanity projects that offer scant hope of a return. The government could retrench from areas such as tech, where private firms may invest, improving areas where they will not, such as education and enhancing the business environment, would do more for long-term growth. A new investment law is welcome, but businesses remain unsure their rights will be upheld, especially if they clash with the government. The stakes for MBS in his country are high. Social liberalization has bought him some time among a youthful population. However, if economic change stalls and Saudis' livelihoods suffer, their goodwill could easily dissipate. Unrest at home could lead the government to crack down, undoing the progress the kingdom has made. Saudi Arabia has come a long way in just a few years, but it still has far to go. And our second leader's article is titled An Existential Struggle, What Putin Wants and How Europe Should Thwart Him. Subheading, many Europeans are complacent about the threat Russia poses and misunderstand how to deter its president. In Red Square, on May 9th, Vladimir Putin is due to celebrate Victory Day, marking the defeat of Nazi Germany. The parade used to include Russia's Second World allies. Today, as Mr. Putin targets what he absurdly claims is another Nazi government in Ukraine, it signals how Russia stands resolutely against the West, and that should worry all of Europe. As the death toll in Ukraine has grown, Mr. Putin's war aims have swollen to justify Russian losses. What began as a special military operation next door has become Russia's existential struggle against distant enemies. This is a profound shift. It means Ukraine's future depends on Mr. Putin's ambitions more than President Donald Trump's theatrical diplomacy. It also means that many Europeans are complacent about the threat Russia poses and that they misunderstand how to deter him. Russia may not be about to invade other parts of Europe, but it will try to gain sway by redoubling its cyber attacks, influence operations, assassinations, and sabotage. If Mr. Putin senses weakness, he could seek to split apart NATO by seizing a small piece of territory and daring the Allies to respond. He could be ready for that in 2 to 5 years. This may sound like a long time, but in military planning, it's the blink of an eye. Many people in America and Southern Europe will find these claims hysterical. Some, like America's envoy Steve Witkoff, say that Mr. Putin can be trusted, or that he would not dare violate Mr. Trump's putative peace deal. Others, though wise enough not to trust a man who's gone to war 5 times in 25 years, argue that Russia is too weak to pose much threat. In Ukraine, it has suffered almost 1 million dead and wounded, and since its gains in the first weeks after the invasion, it has taken less than 1% more of Ukraine's territory. Many in the Baltic states, Poland, and the Nordic countries go to the other extreme, warning that the threat is bigger than Mr. Putin because Russian imperialism has deep roots. That fear is understandable given their history of being mauled, but it is the wrong way to approach Russia. Not only does it affirm Mr. Putin's message that NATO is incurably anti-Russian, but it makes Europe more likely to miss chances for détente. Mr. Putin is indeed an aggressor who needs to be deterred. A bad peace deal imposed on Ukraine could become a springboard for his next war. At the same time, however, even if Mr. Putin is implacable, he is 72 years old, now is the moment to influence what comes after him. Deterrence depends on understanding the threat Mr. Putin poses. After 3 years of fighting, war has become an ideology. In the past, 60% of Russians said that the government's priority should be to raise living standards. Today, that share has fallen to 41%. Instead, 55% now say they want Russia to be respected as a world power. Mr. Putin has put the whole of Russian society onto a war footing. The arms industry creates employment. Generous payments to soldiers and their families amount to 1.5% of GDP. Mr. Putin also uses war as his excuse for ever harsher repression and isolation from the West. It's wrong to think that Russia's forces are spent or incapable. The Navy and Air Force are largely intact. NATO's top commander says Mr. Putin is restocking men, arms, and munitions at an unprecedented pace. Russia plans to have 1.5 million active troops, up from 1.3 million in September. Eventually, it could boost forces and kit on the Western Front by 30 to 50%. Thanks to the war, it has deepened ties to China, Iran, and North Korea. Russian tactics are crude and costly, but a sudden small incursion into a NATO member would force NATO to choose whether to take back lost ground and risk nuclear war. If it did not fight, NATO would be broken. In a longer conflict, NATO could surely repel a first Russian offensive, but would it have the resources for a fifth or sixth? Mr. Putin might count it a strategic victory if Mr. Trump declined to turn up, even if Russia were pushed back. That's because America's absence on the battlefield would entrench Russia's influence over Europe. Defense against Russia begins in Ukraine. The more Mr. Putin is denied success there, the less likely he is to attack NATO. As The Economist has argued, that means supplying Ukraine with arms as well as giving it more money to pay for those it can build cheaply itself. Ukraine could produce $35 billion worth of kit a year, but has orders for less than half that much. Mr. Trump should see that financing Ukraine is in America's interests, if only because China is watching Russia's progress. However, backing Ukraine is not enough to make the entire continent safe, and Mr. Trump is unlikely to offer much help, so Europe must do more. That means working harder to defend itself, shoring up its unity, and laying the foundation for a post-Putin Russia. Europe is buying more arms. New figures from SIPRI, S-I-P-R-I, a Swedish think tank, show that NATO, excluding America, increased spending by $68 billion, or 19%, in 2022 and 23. More is needed, but European leaders have still not prepped voters for the sacrifices ahead. They are squabbling over arms contracts. For example, Britain may not be allowed to join a European Union scheme unless it lets EU boats fish in its waters. Work is needed to enhance NATO's unity, especially if America no longer binds it together. It is naive, to think that countries like Spain and Portugal will ever fear Russia, as Estonia and Poland do, but they face threats to their infrastructure and politics. They also have a vital interest in the EU being spared the dysfunction that would result from greater Russian influence over its eastern members. Last, Europe needs a Russia policy that looks beyond Ukraine. In the Cold War, the West persuaded ordinary Russians it was on their side, and that what kept them from freedom and prosperity was the Soviet regime. It cultivated dissidence and encouraged contacts. Today, too many Europeans are hostile to all Russians, rather than just the warmongers. Europe has the wealth and industrial power to withstand Mr. Putin. It has the potential to find an accommodation with his successor. As Russian soldiers strut through Red Square, the question is whether Europe can overcome its divisions in order to save Ukraine and protect itself. And our third leader's article is titled The Himalayas of Peace. Luck stands between de-escalation and disaster for India and Pakistan. Subheading here is, sooner or later, the luck will run out. The spectacle of India and Pakistan teetering on the threshold of war and then backing off is both alarming and familiar. This time the odds remain in favor of de-escalation as before, yet the past 2 weeks show that relations between the two nuclear powers, which have flared into open conflict 4 times since partition in 1947, are increasingly unstable and dangerous. It's more important than ever that the two sides address their differences, including Pakistan's reckless indulgence of militant groups, which threatens itself and India. On May 7th, Indian missiles struck Pakistan in the Pakistani-ruled part of Kashmir, a territory both sides claim. These were in retaliation for a terrorist attack on April 22nd that killed 26 civilians in the part of Kashmir that India controls. It says it has intercepts that show militants from Pakistan were to blame. Pakistan, meanwhile, denies this and says it has shot down several Indian warplanes. It's threatening further counterstrikes. Artillery duels along the de facto border in Kashmir are growing in intensity and killing civilians. The outside world, following a well-worn script, has urged both sides to step back. Something like this pattern has occurred several times since 2000, yet look closer, and this conflict is changing. Pakistan's decay has been unstoppable. The country endures a rolling economic crisis. Its democracy is rigged by its army, led since late 2022 by General Asim Munir, a pious hardliner. Remarkably, the state enables or tolerates militant groups within its borders, including Lashkar-e-Taiba, L-E-T, which has a history of atrocities against Indians. Other terrorists, including those operating from Afghanistan, killed 1,612 Pakistanis last year in 444 attacks, the worst toll for a decade. As Pakistan sinks, India is rising. Its GDP is now 10 times larger than its troubled neighbor, having been 5 times larger back in 2000. New weapons technology is changing the conflict, too. India has increased arms spending since the last mini-war in 2019. It has acquired warplanes from France and boosted its drone capabilities. Pakistan, for its part, has bought new fighters and missiles from China, from which it now imports 81% of its arms, up from 38% just 15 years ago. Following the wind down of the war on terror and the fall of Kabul to the Taliban in 2021, America and Europe pay less attention to Pakistan. Once Western presidents and prime ministers had to indulge, humor, bribe, and threaten Pakistan in order to ensure its half cooperation. Now they more often just ignore it. The combination of an unstable Pakistan, an arms race, and outside indifference is dangerous. Fortunately, the military exchanges so far have been measured. True, India's missiles struck deeper into Pakistan than ever and hit more sites, but they appear to have targeted militant camps. Its aircraft remained in Indian airspace. During skirmishes in 2019, the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi foolishly stoked jingoism at home. This time, government rhetoric and the public mood have been more restrained. Pakistan, meanwhile, may have salved its wounded prime by shooting down Indian warplanes, possibly using Chinese air-to-air missiles. It reserves the right to take further action. India says it has foiled one attempt by Pakistan to hit back with drones and missiles. Still, there is an off-ramp from Armageddon. Unfortunately, unless the conflict's underlying causes are tackled, it will surely flare up again. India needs to end its self-defeating repression of the part of Kashmir that it controls. This has a Muslim majority and has been subject to more centralized administration since 2019, resulting in militarization, clampdowns on free speech, and abuses of human rights. But the bigger problem is Pakistan's tolerance of militants, which it has long viewed as a source of asymmetric leverage. Although Pakistan's involvement in the atrocity of April 22nd is not proven, a group linked to LET initially claimed responsibility. It then issued a denial, saying its social media had been hacked. Pakistan's time-worn strategy is to sponsor destabilizing attacks and then call for stability. America has some bargaining power, and the Trump administration should urge Pakistan's government to shut down terror camps and prosecute militant leaders. International organizations that still have influence over Pakistan, including the IMF and the Global Anti-Terrorist Financing Watchdog, should demand it does more. In the new multipolar world, other countries should pull their weight too. China has become Pakistan's most powerful patron, but its citizens have been victims of terrorism there. The Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, should push pressure on Pakistan. They've long been friendly with it, but their economic interests are now aligned with giant India. With luck, the latest outbreak of violence will fit the familiar pattern, but sooner or later that luck will run out. And our fourth Leader's article is titled, Israel's Forever Conflict, The War in Gaza Must End. Subheading, America should press Benjamin Netanyahu to accept a ceasefire and then press Hamas to disarm. This time, Israeli officials insist things will be different. On May 5th, the cabinet approved a new plan for Gaza. It aims to mobilize tens of thousands of reservists. The army will reoccupy a part of the enclave, razing some buildings as it goes. Palestinians will be displaced to a sliver of land in southern Gaza. In parallel, Israel will let some aid into the strip, which it has blockaded since March 2nd. It will be stockpiled at hubs guarded by American mercenaries. Families will come once a fortnight to collect food and some essentials. Supporters of this plan claim it will be decisive, destroying what remains of Hamas by denying it space to regroup or oppress Gazans and depriving it of food to feed its fighters. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, has spent 18 months promising total victory. The plan's backers argue they need just a few more months to achieve it. There is no reason to believe that they're right. For a start, the operation is unlikely to free the hostages who remain imprisoned in Gaza. Israel's army has morale problems, and some units, only 50% of reservists, report for duty. Polls show that more than 60% of Israelis oppose an offensive to reoccupy Gaza. Israel has already smashed Hamas's leadership, its rocket arsenal, and its ability to mount complex attacks. What remains is a ragtag guerrilla force, which Israel will struggle to destroy because fresh recruits are plentiful. Given that Rump Hamas cannot muster much firepower, it may not be worth destroying. The new plan will bring further agony for Gazans. More than 2,000 have died since Israel resumed fighting in March, bringing the cumulative total to a grim 52,000. Civilians are going hungry because of the blockade. Israel's scheme for supplying aid will offer scant relief. It makes no provision for people who are sick or unable to trek to a distribution center. The only people who benefit from continuing war are Mr. Netanyahu, who keeps his coalition intact, and his far-right allies who dream of emptying Gaza and rebuilding Jewish settlements there. If they were to get their way, 2 million people would be crammed into 25% of Gaza's territory with subsistence rations. Some ministers already gloat that such conditions would drive Gazans into exile, and that would count as ethnic cleansing. Food should not be used as a weapon. Israel must allow aid into Gaza and let charities distribute it. Some will be stolen by Hamas, which cares little for the plight of Gazans. That's bad, but the alternative would be starvation. Beyond that, it's past time for a lasting ceasefire. Donald Trump should demand that Mr. Netanyahu agrees to one in exchange for release of all hostages. No other leader can compel him. The president is eager for a foreign policy win, and when he visits the Gulf next week, Arab leaders should urge him to pursue this one. Then America should apply pressure to Hamas using the strongest remaining tool at its disposal, reconstruction. The UN estimates it will cost $53 billion over the next decade. Mr. Trump should issue an ultimatum. Donors will not pledge a dollar until Hamas agrees to cede power and disarm. America's allies will need little convincing. Most want Hamas gone. The odds are that Hamas will try to cling to power, but it will have to answer to its own people. Thousands of Gazans have already joined protests demanding its ousting. Perhaps their ranks will swell, and if Hamas ever posed a serious threat to Israel, then Israel would be entitled to strike again. That outcome would be bleak, but the present course is bleaker. More Gazans will die from shelling and starvation. Hostages will perish in captivity. An endless war will deepen the rifts in Israel and further damage its standing in the world. Israel has achieved a string of victories over its foes. If it ends up depopulating and reoccupying Gaza, it will commit a strategic blunder and a moral outrage. And just before the halfway mark in today's reading, we remind you you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper. And we are reading from the May 10 through 16 edition of The Economist. And our fifth and final leader's article is titled Illusion of Control. Donald Trump is right to ditch Joe Biden's chip export rules. Subheading, Time to Get Realistic. For years now, America has grappled with how best to protect its lead in the artificial intelligence race. Its weapon of choice has been export controls on the sale of AI chips to China, but as we report this week, controls so far have been leaky. A burgeoning gray market exists for the wares of NVIDIA, America's chip champion. Chinese firms lease access to offshore data centers or buy chips through intermediaries. Export controls have conspicuously failed to stop Chinese tech from surprising the world. The Biden administration thought the answer was to cast a wider net. In its final days, it announced a sweeping plan for a licensing regime that would have spanned much of the globe. Unfortunately, this would have been a bureaucratic nightmare, and on May 7th, the Trump administration rightly said it would ditch the rules and replace them with something simpler. As it rethinks its approach, it should proceed with care. Chip restrictions may offer the illusion of control, but they bring with them a range of unwanted consequences. The problem with the Biden rules was that they were unworkably complicated. Close allies would have faced new restrictions. China and Russia would have been barred outright. But some 120 middle countries, such as India, Singapore, and the United Arab Emirates, would have become subject to a labyrinth licensing regime. Tracking the use of chips around the world would have been impossible. The Bureau of Industry and Security, or BIS, which was supposed to enforce it, is short-staffed and poorly equipped. As the Trump administration mulls new rules, it needs to be realistic. Chip controls are always going to be leaky. Export controls can work if they're narrowly applied. Banning China from importing extreme ultraviolet or EUV lithography machines has successfully delayed its efforts to make the most advanced chips, for instance. But EUV tools are easy to track. They're made only by ASML, a Dutch firm, and only around 50 of them are sold every year, each weighing more than 100 tons. Controlling the sale of AI chips is a different story. They're smaller, more versatile, and far more numerous. NVIDIA alone expects to sell more than 6 million of them this year. Moreover, chip controls on China will have a half-life. For more than a decade, China's government has poured billions of dollars into its semiconductor sector in the hopes of achieving self-sufficiency. But the breakthroughs came in earnest only after America began tightening its export controls, giving businesses a reason to look for alternatives. Huawei, China's tech champion, recently unveiled an AI system that is set to match NVIDIA on some measures. China still relies on foreign tools and lags behind on chips at the cutting edge, but it is closing the gap. This means that widening the net to others will bring few benefits but big costs. A wide-ranging system of licenses would do little to stymie China, but it would push middle countries towards Chinese suppliers, not because they prefer them, but because their chips are easier to obtain. Mr. Trump's administration is reportedly considering using access to AI chips as a bargaining chip in trade talks. But if a rules-based system descends into wheeling and dealing, many countries may see American suppliers as unreliable. This could shrink American firms' market share and diminish their technological leadership. Chip controls alone cannot be America's way of staying ahead. At best, they might buy some time. At worst, they don't work at all. If America is to win the AI race, it will need all the ingenuity, talent, and friends that it can get. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin with the lead article from the section on the United States. And this one is titled, After Grants Pass, American cities are criminalizing homelessness. Will that help? Subheading, How a Supreme Court Decision Paved the Way for More Punitive Policies. Davina Valenzuela watches as the sanitation workers heave most of her belongings into a garbage truck. The 33-year-old has been homeless for more than a year and was sleeping in a dusty alley in central Fresno, the biggest city in California's Central Valley. The truck devours bags of clothes, a pushchair or stroller, a pile of hypodermic needles, and around $120, much of it in change. Police officers arrest her and a friend and sit them in the back of a truck. They're given tickets for camping in a public place, which became a misdemeanor in September in an attempt to shrink the city's homeless encampments. "That's all I have, right there," she says once her handcuffs are taken off. "I don't know how I ended up here." Roughly 771,000 Americans were homeless last year, more than any other year on record, and an 18% increase from 2023. A national housing shortage is by far the biggest culprit, but the end of pandemic rental assistance, an increase in migration and natural disasters that displaced people are also contributed to the surge. Only about 35% of homeless people in America sleep outdoors rather than in shelters or temporary housing, but that's a higher proportion than in most other places tracked by the OECD, a club of mostly rich countries. Rough sleepers are more likely than their sheltered peers to be homeless for long stretches of time. Many of them struggle openly with drug addiction and mental health problems, which can make tent camps look and feel unsafe. The entrenchment of homeless encampments has frustrated both voters, who wonder where the billions of dollars poured into fixing homelessness have gone, and politicians, whose careers may ride on fixing the problem. A backlash is well underway. Last June, the Supreme Court ruled in Grants Pass versus Johnson that punishing homeless people for sleeping outside when they have nowhere else to go was not a cruel and unusual punishment, which is banned by the Eighth Amendment. At least 163 municipalities have passed camping restrictions since then, according to the National Homelessness Law Center, an advocacy group. Almost a third of those bans are in California, which has both more homeless people than any other state and the highest proportion of rough sleepers. The result is a country that, city by city, is trying to end outdoor homelessness by force. To understand how these bans are being implemented, consider Fresno, where there are more homeless people in the region than there are beds. Residents report encampments they want cleaned up to the city via an app. A special team of police officers and sanitation workers investigate these spots and make arrests. Sergeant Stephen Jacques, who runs the team, argues that the camping ban gives his officers leverage. Violators could face up to $1,000 in fines, an astronomical amount for someone living on the street, or a year in jail. But in lieu of punishment, they can ask police to take them to a shelter where they can inquire about housing or treatment. If they complete a rehab program, their citation goes away. But if, like Ms. Valenzuela, they refuse the offer, tickets can accrue. As of April 25th, the city's attorney's office had filed charges in 266 cases. Only 33 of them were resolved because the person charged had accepted services. How harshly people will be punished is still unknown. The first case to make it to trial was dismissed by the judge for taking too long. Move on. Fresno's leaders consider the camping ban a success and insist that outdoor homelessness is declining. But the most recent official statistics are 2 years old. Des Martinez was once homeless and now advocates for her, quote, street family, end quote, in Fresno. She reckons people are just hiding from the cops by moving under highway overpasses and tying their belongings to trees. Jerry Dyer, Fresno's Republican mayor and former police chief, doesn't mind if that's true. I'm sure there are people that have chosen places now that are less visible publicly, which isn't a bad thing for businesses, he offers, though he'd prefer people to seek help. Yet if homeless people go into hiding, it becomes hard to know how many of them there are. The city can claim success, but the problem may persist in the shadows. Mr. Dyer contends it's more compassionate to coerce homeless Fresnans to accept housing or treatment rather than to allow them to suffer on the streets. Despite their different political parties, he sounds remarkably like Gavin Newsom, California's Democratic governor, who argued that lower court rulings previously limiting enforcement against camps had tied the hands of officials. The Cicero Institute, a conservative think tank in Austin, Texas, started by Joe Lonsdale, a tech billionaire, pushes a similar argument as it works to pass state camping bans. We have deep discomfort with forcing people to do things, so says Devin Kurtz, who studies homelessness at Cicero, but he asks fairly, is it okay to let them die out here? The fact that so many Republicans and Democrats are on the same side illustrates how frustration with the status quo has scrambled to the politics of homelessness. Many on the left were once wary of clearing encampments for fear that breaking up communities and trashing people's belongings could be traumatic for them. That argument is little heard these days. The risk is that these camping bans prove to be too big a stick and eventually follow the same pattern as anti-vagrancy laws passed during the 19th century, filling jails and hospitals with people whose crime is having nowhere to live. There's a very sordid history of moving from criminalizing people who are destitute to then institutionalizing them. That's a quotation from Dennis Culhane of the University of Pennsylvania. Not every city has taken a punitive approach. Los Angeles is clearing encampments without the threat of citation or jail, and the number of rough sleepers there dropped by 10% between 2023 and 2024. But it's far too soon to celebrate. The number of unsheltered homeless people in LA, adjusted for the city's population, remains among the highest in the country. While cities experiment with camping bans, housing wonks warn that new federal policies could worsen homelessness. In President Donald Trump's budget request, which is mostly a wish list, funding for the Department of Housing and Urban Development would be slashed by 44%, jeopardizing rental assistance programs that help poor, or rather help keep poor, Americans housed. We'll all be at Donald Trump's house if big cuts are implemented, jokes Ms. Martinez, quote, camping on the White House lawn, end quote. And turning next to the section on Middle East and Africa, we have an article titled The Red Sea, a Faustian Pact with the Houthis. Subheading, a new American deal strengthens their grip over Yemen. Over the course of 7 weeks, Donald Trump, America's president, bombed the Houthis, Yemeni rebels backed by Iran, over 1,000 times. That was twice the number of strikes his predecessor launched in over a year. Then, unexpectedly, the bombing stopped. On May 6th, in a press conference with Canada's Prime Minister, Mr. Trump casually mentioned he had landed a deal with the Houthis. We will stop the bombings, he explained, in return for a cessation of Houthi attacks on shipping. Freedom of navigation for international commercial shipping in the Red Sea. That's a quote tweeted by the Omani Foreign Minister, Badr al-Busaidi, who brokered the agreement soon after. Many things explain Mr. Trump's change, of course. The cost of the campaign, estimated to be $1 billion, was heavy. The attacks had failed to deter the Houthis, and they threatened to fuel conflict just as the president was heading to the Middle East to promote peace. The Iranians had suspended negotiations about their nuclear program after Pete Hegseth, the American Secretary of Defense, warned Iran that it would pay for its lethal support of the Houthis. On May 4th, one of the Houthis' missiles pierced Israel's defenses and struck the outskirts of its main airport in Tel Aviv. In response, Israel destroyed Hodeidah, a Yemeni port, the capital's airport, and 3 civilian aircraft and 2 big cement plants. The old Middle East, pitting America and Israel against Iran and its proxies, seemed to be back. The immediate beneficiary of the apparent détente is Iran. Having parked the Houthi problem, Mr. Trump looks closer than ever to a deal with the Ayatollahs. Iran quickly declared it would resume a fourth round of talks within days. A draft agreement is said to be circulating that could see the Islamic Republic and America restore diplomatic relations after 45 years. If that materializes, technical teams would finalize a deal that lets Iran enrich uranium to low levels in perpetuity. Ahead of his trip to the Gulf on May 13th, Mr. Trump has already let slip that a very, very big announcement is coming. Things are moving very fast, says an observer in touch with both the Iranians and the Americans. The Houthis are also crowing. Mr. Trump said they had capitulated. The rebels insist America beat a retreat. American strikes have damaged but not eliminated the Houthis' long-range missile arsenal. They remain Yemen's most powerful force. The leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah, the other members of Iran's axis of resistance, have fallen. Abdel Malik al-Houthi is its last man standing. We didn't expect Trump would surrender to the Houthis and hand them a victory for free, says Abdul Ghani al-Iryani, a Yemen analyst. Others are counting their losses. The deal leaves 25 million Yemenis under the Houthis' yoke. A decade of airstrikes that began with the Saudis has crippled infrastructure. The Houthis tax heavily, but show scant interest in service delivery. Instead, they focus on bolstering their forces, tightening their group, and indoctrinating the population with religious dogma and hate speech. They're worse than the Taliban, says a Yemeni visitor to Sana'a, the capital. The Houthis' Yemeni rivals are smarting too. Some had hoped that under American pressure, the group might at last accede to a power-sharing agreement and let the internationally recognized government return to the capital. Others hoped to exploit American mission creep and relaunch a ground assault. Now they fear it could be the Houthis who advance. None of Yemen's other forces can match the rebel group. Their force has grown 12-fold to 350,000 since 2015, according to the UN, a year after they seized Sana'a. And, unlike their Yemeni opponents, they're disciplined and battle-ready. Prepare for Houthi attacks on the oil fields near Marib and Shabwa, say Yemen watchers. Most surprising is Mr. Trump's abandonment of Israel. He launched his campaign in March when the Houthis resumed their attacks on Israel, but the deal does nothing to constrain Houthi strikes against America's ally. The Houthis say they will continue firing at Israel as long as Israel maintains its blockade of Gaza. It might be a sign of Mr. Trump's frustration with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, or of his determination to secure a deal with Iran. Either way, Israel seems unusually out of the loop. And turning next to the section on Britain, we have an article titled "The Double Trust. Nigel Farage's economic plans are a disaster." Subheading, three choices: fiscal implosion, deep austerity, or a hasty U-turn. When Reform UK sent five members to Parliament last July, Nigel Farage, the Populist Party's leader, called it a bridgehead. Thumping wins across England's local elections on May 1st marked the next stage of the assault. Now Reform is neck and neck with Labour in the polls. Success means scrutiny. As a protest party, Reform, like earlier Farage Ventures, was distinguished mainly by a penchant for scandal and an uncanny ability to nudge the Tories into unforced errors. Now the notion that Reform could be a party of government no longer seems fanciful. Its ideas should be taken seriously. Unfortunately, the mishmash on office so far is highly alarming. Reform's policies add up to an agenda of fiscal recklessness that rivals and may well exceed the disastrous 49-day hair-raising, market-tanking premiership of Liz Truss in 2022. Reform's manifesto from the 2024 election is a starting point. The party has since crab-walked away from the document, but it remains the only entry under policies on its website. More tellingly, a Mr. Farage has specifically reaffirmed or expanded on nearly half the tax cuts listed in recent months. The manifesto puts Reform's giveaways at £140 billion per year, but claims to offset them with savings worth £160 billion. Even on a generous but realistic accounting, The Economist estimates the annual costs are in the region of £200 billion and savings around £100 billion. The gap between the two would amount to a colossal fiscal shock, blowing up the deficit and straining the gilt markets to its limits. Why the mismatch? Take taxes first. The changes are so vast that precise costings are futile. But Reform has made serially generous guesses. The party claims its personal tax cuts cost about £70 billion per year, but the proposed lift to income tax thresholds alone would cost at least that much and probably more based on rules of thumb from HMRC, the tax agency. Adding cuts to fuel duty, stamp duty, VAT, inheritance tax, and you have tens of billions more. Recently, Mr. Farage has doubled down on his single costliest pledge to lift the personal allowance for income tax from £12,570 to £20,000, and he now wants to fully abolish inheritance tax. The manifesto promises businesses £18 billion of giveaways too, but the promise to cut corporate tax by 10 percentage points alone is worth double that. And the realistic take from one of reform's main revenue raisers, dropping some interest payments on the Bank of England reserves, is a mere fraction of the £35 billion already stated. Then comes spending. Reform wants £30 to £40 billion more for health, defense, and fighting crime. To pay and cover tax cuts, the party relies on hand-waving and austerity. Questionably, it asserts that its policies will add 1 percentage point to growth, which nearly doubles it, and take 1 million Britons off benefits. In addition, it suggests a 5% cut across government, austerity not far off the 2010s, plus unfathomably a vast savings from ending net zero. Delivering even the viable cuts would be hard. Reform's leaders ask act Thatcherite, but many of their voters are big staters. An early test was Labour's cuts to winter fuel payments, an unnecessary subsidy for richer pensioners. Reform has loudly campaigned to restore them. Outside of tax and spend, its wider agenda of net zero migration and expensively burying electricity pylons is hardly more promising. The general election is still years away, but at some point sooner, the infrastructure investors Labour hopes to woo will start pricing in the risk that reform could be serious about implementing these ideas. Britain has to keep bond vigilantes on side to fund its borrowing habit. Ms. Truss's recklessness and the Brexit saga have already strained patience. More such episodes would start to look not like aberrations, but parts of a pattern. Even the man Mr. Farage calls his friend in Washington lost a staring match with the bond market over tariffs. Reform now has 4 years to choose between a serious rethink or the risk of a fiscal calamity if it wins. Maybe being no-hopers wasn't so bad after all. And turning next to the section on business, we have an article titled Battle of the Bulge. Eli Lilly looks set to steal Novo Nordisk's weight loss crown. Subheading, despite a late start, the American firm is bearing down on its Danish rival. Being first to market with a drug can be crucial. Eli Lilly proved that, but being second but better can also pay. Zepbound, the American firm's weight loss jab, was approved in its home country in November of 2023, more than 2 years after Wegovy, made by Novo Nordisk, a Danish rival. Over the following year, it yielded $4.9 billion in revenue, more than half Wegovy's $8.2 billion. On May 7th, Novo cut its sales forecast for 2025, citing lower-than-planned growth in weight loss drugs. Its share price has fallen by a third since the start of 2024. Lilly's has risen by about as much. The momentum is now with Lilly. Visible Alpha, a data firm, expected sales of obesity drugs to overtake Novo's by 2027. Lilly's edge rests more on an effective drug, better execution, keener pricing, and a stronger pipeline. Zepbound and Wegovy belong to a class of treatments known as GLP-1 agonists. First developed for diabetes, they suppress appetite by slowing digestion. Wegovy mimics the GLP-1 hormone. Zepbound targets an additional hormone, GIP, thought to enhance weight loss. That dual action matters. In a head-to-head trial conducted by Lilly, patients on Wegovy lost 14% of their body weight. Those on Zepbound, 20%. A third of Zepbound users shed at least 25%, twice this year for Wegovy. Prescribing has shifted. In the first quarter of 2025, Zepbound made up 60% of total weight loss prescriptions in America and 75% of new ones. Lilly has also been quicker to expand production in response to soaring demand. Wegovy was America's official shortage on the official shortage list until February, and Lilly had sorted out its supply issues by last October. That left Novo more exposed to compounding pharmacies, which may copy branded drugs during shortages at much lower prices. Novo expects revenue to rise now that the Wegovy shortage is resolved and sales of copycats must stop. Battles over price regulation in America, the largest market, are another concern. Mr. Trump wants to match prices abroad, which are typically lower. Medicare, which covers 66 million Americans, has also dropped the plan to reimburse obesity drugs. Even so, both firms can look forward to fat profits. More than 100 companies are developing weight loss drugs, but for now, it's a duopoly. Analysts expect that by 2030, Lilly will have 47% of a $90 billion-plus market to Novo's 40%. And Denmark's former star still has time to shape up. And in the short time remaining, we'll cover some short items from the politics section. Raining on his parade, Ukraine launched a big drone attack on Russia, which caused Moscow's four airports to close temporarily. The attack came shortly before a smattering of world leaders arrived in Russia to attend Vladimir Putin's military parade to mark 80 years since the end of the Second World War in Europe. Xi Jinping was the guest of honor. China's leader was starting a four-day visit to Russia, which includes talks with Mr. Putin. And the European Commission laid out a roadmap to remove all imports of Russian oil, gas, and nuclear energy from EU markets. The plan envisages stopping all imports of Russian gas by the end of 2027, with new contracts halted by the end of this year. Legislation for that will be introduced next month. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the May 10 through 16 edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.